Well, the Supreme Court of the United States finished its current term this past Monday when it handed down its 80th and 81st decision since October of 2015. There is rarely unanimous agreement among the justices of the current court, which means that for every majority opinion written, there is a dissenting one, and sometimes it is the dissent that draws greater attention. Case in point, for the decision handed down last week in Utah versus Streiff, Associate Justice Sonia Sotomayor wrote a dissent described as blistering, fiery, and ringing, and she took the majority to task on the matter of illegal stops by law enforcement. Let me tell you, folks, it's a great read, even if you're not Nina Totenberg. But other than venting, what's the purpose of writing a dissenting opinion? Here to help us answer that question is Edward Cantu. He's Associate Professor at the UMKC School of Law. And Ed, welcome to Up to Date. So good to have you.
Yeah, good to be here.
Did you get a chance to read Justice Sotomayor's dissent?
I did.
What'd you make of it?
What did I make of it? Well, I think she said a lot of things that a lot of people on the certain end of the racial politics spectrum have been wanting to hear a justice say for quite some time, for better or for worse. On the one end, people say we finally have someone on the court who's giving voice to this sentiment that a lot of what police officers do and a lot of what the federal courts enable them to do actually adds to the systemic problem of racial minorities being harassed by law enforcement. On the other end of the spectrum, you have people who think that it was little more than a racial politics screed that was very unbecoming of a justice. And there are good arguments on both sides of that coin.
So these adjectives that were applied to her dissent, words like blistering, fiery, and ringing, you would say those are fairly accurate, it sounds like.
Blistering, yes. Fiery, yes. Ringing sounds more like an exaltation of it. And personally, I wouldn't go so far as to exalt her dissent. But
is there a word you'd slap on it?
I think the first two are probably definitely edgy, at the very least, yes.
You know, if more than one justice, Edward, is in the minority, then who gets to write the dissent?
That's generally decided by the principal, the most senior justice who is in the dissent. So in this case, it was Ginsburg. She is the justice who had been on the court the longest, who was in the dissenting group of justices. She can decide the right to the dissent herself, or she can assign it to somebody. In this case, she apparently assigned it to Justice Kagan, who wrote the.
So the most senior justice on the dissenting side assigns the opinion then.
Assigns the principal dissenting opinion. Of course, any other justice is free to write their own dissenting opinion, which is what Sotomayor did in this case.
Why would somebody do that? Why just add your opinion to the mix on top of the principal dissenting opinion?
You used the word venting in your introduction. and as much maybe it's as unprofessorial to say that that's really what it boils down to, I think that's really what it is. There used to be a time, actually, when justices rarely dissented. Because if you think about it, what's the reason besides saying passionately, I think the court is wrong? I mean, a justice's job is to be part of the institution of the court. And therefore, if what they're saying is not speaking on behalf of the court, then what exactly are they doing? Well, they're just disagreeing with the institution of which they're a part, and that begs the question of what the value of that is. So the norm used to be that justices, if they disagreed, they just you know, kept it to themselves. But increasingly with the culture wars being reflected on the federal bench, you've seen a gradual tendency for justices to increasingly dissent, to the point now where we have justices who we see many different dissents in the same case, like we saw in Streiff.
Do those multitude of dissents, do they end up carrying any legal weight over time? Or, again, is it just an emotional venting here, I guess, to use your word?
Well, yeah, and I don't mean to give the impression that's the only value of dissents or the only purpose of them. They carry no formal legal weight, but they do often anyway end up influencing the development of particular areas of doctrine. A good example of this would be Justice Brennan's dissents in the Fourth Amendment context. Brennan was someone who was particularly capable in decisions from the Burger Court era, the 1970s going into the 80s, of really encapsulating why, for example, it was important to suppress evidence when the evidence was discovered through police investigatory misconduct. This is called the suppression rule, which the average person thinks is nothing but a technicality that allows defendants to just walk free. But actually, Brennan was particularly good at conditioning legal culture to understand that the suppression rule really represents much more than just a technicality. And so with time, what we see are people like Justice Sotomayor in the Fourth Amendment context who will go back 30 years and quote a lot of Brennan's dissenting opinions in order to really capture why it's so important to enforce the suppression rule in contexts where it might be unsavory to do so.
So it sounds like there is some value then in these dissents over time.
That there is.
If Sotomayor is going back to what Brennan said 30 years ago, that's valuable to her, it sounds
like. It is valuable. Of course, that brings to light the distinction between purpose and effect. If the question is, what is the purpose? I think it's largely venting. But I think also justices understand that their venting may have a constructive effect in the distant or near future as well. So that's another reason to dissent.
That's interesting. Well, some dissents bear fruit long after they've been written. I'm thinking about Brown versus Board of Education striking down school segregation back in 1954. That decision can trace itself back to the lone dissenter in an 1896 Supreme Court case, again, a famous case, Plessy versus Ferguson, when Justice John Marshall Harlan wrote, "Our Constitution is colorblind." What role does shifting attitudes play in making an old dissent relevant again?
Pretty much that's the only thing that makes an old dissent relevant, right? It's when what we see with individual rights decisions really is that the court doesn't come down with a bold, brave decision until a critical mass of the country actually morally comes around to supporting that particular point of view. And so when that happens, the court can now go dig out some old dissenting opinion that represents that moral position. And I think that Brown is a good example of that. So that's really the only time an old dissent becomes relevant again is when times have changed and people have now sort of, if you will, caught up with that dissenter's point of view.
We're talking about the value of dissents in U.S. Supreme Court cases. My guest is Edward Cantu. He's an associate professor at the UMKC School of Law. What's it mean for the justice writing for the majority when that justice knows there will be a dissent published along with his or her opinion?
It probably means they have to bring their A game, and they know it. And I think this is maybe one of the things that have led to opinions becoming longer. Many law students understandably lament, as do professors do, the increasing length of opinions. But there tends to be more of a perceived need to justify one's position in a majority opinion nowadays.
If you notice the case, these opinions are getting longer all the time?
They are getting longer, yes. And part of that—
Has that been studied somewhere and word counts rendered?
I believe it has. I don't remember who did it or when it was done, but— you know, especially older attorneys who can remember reading Supreme Court opinions back in the Burger Court era or in the Warren Court era. Brandenburg versus Ohio, a famous First Amendment decision, was very short. Now we get affirmative action decisions and free speech decisions and abortion decisions that are much longer.
Do long opinions tend to muddy the law over time because there's so many words to rake through and meanings can get misconstrued in a longer opinion more than a short opinion?
Yeah, I think ostensibly the purpose is to clarify through verbosity, but often it's the effect is the opposite because what you do, especially with someone like Justice Kennedy, who tends to include a lot of very vague verbiage, flowery verbiage in some of his opinions, they give sort of rhetorical ammunition to future judges to interpret the case a particular way or for a future Supreme Court judge or even Justice Kennedy himself to later go back and say what I meant by this sort of indeterminate, ambiguous phraseology was actually this. So all sorts of reasons and or effects of those kinds of things.
Do scholars like you, are you able to, in your mind, sort of label each of the justices in terms of their style of writing? And you mentioned that Kennedy writes in a flowery sort of way. Do each of them have their own particular styles that you've picked up on over the years?
They do. I tend not to pay much careful attention to labeling those particular styles, but I do know generally that particular justices tend to have their own basic flair. Kennedy, you either love him or you hate him for this, depending on which side of the political spectrum you're on. But Kennedy is a very well, what's the word I might use? If you're on the right side, like Justice Scalia, you would say morally pompous, pretentious, mm-hmm. and vain. If you're on the left side, you would say that his phraseology represents this sort of moral progress and discovery about, you know, new meanings and dimensions of freedom and substantive justice. And right. So there are different ways of framing that kind of rhetorical style.
Well, speaking of Scalia, the late justice was known for his dissenting opinions, as you've mentioned here, Edward. Even those who disagree with him admire the way he wrote those dissents. What makes for a good dissenting opinion? I imagine that passion ends up playing a big role here.
Very much so. Mm-hmm. Yeah, especially with Justice Scalia. In fact, if you don't mind,
please.
I make my students in constitutional law every year read this dissenting opinion because I think it so well captures not only just the fun style that he uses, whether you agree with him or not, but also his broader jurisprudential point that he's making with attacks like this about what the proper role of the court is.
Yeah.
So this is his dissent in Obergefell versus Hodges, which of course is the decision recently where the court announced that homosexuals have the constitutional right to marry under the 14th Amendment.
Yeah.
And Scalia chastises the majority for basically removing that issue from public debate where he believes it belongs in the state electoral process and now putting it within the realm of constitutional law. And he says here, the majority's opinion is couched in a style that is as pretentious as its content is egotistic. It is one thing for separate concurring or dissenting opinions to contain extravagances, even silly extravagances, of thought and expression. It is something else for the official opinion of the court to do so. Of course, the opinion's showy profundities are often profoundly incoherent.
So, I wonder if someone like Kennedy reads that and A, gets mad, and B, if he ever sits back in quieter moments and thinks, man, that dude, maybe he had a point. You know?
That's a really good question.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Wonder, don't you?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Some people speculate that Kennedy is just playing for the Beltway crowd and wanting to look like he's on the right side of history. And other people think, no, this is someone who's really come around, appointed by a Republican president, but someone who now recognizes that justices have an obligation to infuse constitutional law with evolving senses of justice and fairness and morality. So, again, it all depends on your point of view.
What else makes for a good dissenting opinion, Edward? What other characteristic would you apply to it? I'm thinking maybe tone, research.
It all depends on what we mean by good, I suppose.
Well, okay, that's a good point.
It's, first of all, analytically powerful. Mm-hmm. That is taking the majority's own rules and using them against the majority. See, different judges have different rules altogether. For example, Ginsburg tends to be very much of a pragmatist. She tends to ask, what are the consequences of this decision? Mm-hmm. And the answer to that question determines whether a particular ruling is good or not. Mm-hmm. Other more conservative justices tend to be more formalistic. They don't focus at least ostensibly as much on consequences. They ask, what decision displays the most fidelity? Fidelity to original intent, the men who wrote and ratified the Constitution, what did they intend when they ratified certain provisions of the Constitution as fundamental law of the land?
You know, when a justice is writing a majority opinion, mm-hmm. does he or she have access to the dissenting opinions at any point in the process?
I don't know the answer to that question, and I've often wondered what the answer to that question is. Clearly, justices have access to other justices' opinions beforehand, but I don't know
if they circulate the majority opinions among the justices I've read.
They do, right. But one big question is, okay, now they circulate the majority opinion. A justice says, I don't like it, I'm going to dissent. And so a draft dissent is issued. Does the majority now see that dissent? Well, to a certain degree, we know that the answer is yes, because the majority often is responding to the dissent directly majority opinion. But I don't know if the dissent then sees that draft response to their dissent, right? A lot of that just may depend on seniority of the justices, but that's always something I've wondered. I'm not sure that information is really out there, like sort of definitively.
I'm wondering why the processes of the U.S. Supreme Court continue to remain under wraps to the extent that they are. I mean, I can remember back in the early 80s when Bob Woodward of All the President's Men fame came out with a big book on the Supreme Court and how it really works. And why is it shrouded in such mystery and intrigue? Why don't scholars like you know how the court works, given its import and impact on this country.
Well, as far as that last sort of uncertainty, that could just be because I haven't brushed up on that particular factoid in a long time.
It could be your fault, not the court's.
That's right. Yeah. I don't want to blame the court on that. But the general point is correct. There is an insularity there that is almost, I think, frankly, inexcusable in a democratic constitutional system.
Well, that's how it always has struck me. Why?
Yeah, I think part of it is if you think about what is the power of the court? The power of the court is its prestige and its image. It really doesn't have anything else, right? The power of the executive is they have the gun. The power of Congress is it has the purse. The power of the court is its prestige, is one of the reasons why they go through so many hoops and long opinions justifying their conclusions.
Mm-hmm.
How unsavory it would look to the public if the public understood the kind of horse trading that went on between chambers in deciding how to decide.
Exactly. Explain that. What do you mean horse trading between chambers? I mean, we're talking about opinions here. There's horse trading that goes on? Because I know there is. I've read it before.
Yes, there clearly is. Every once in a while, you have a sort of a rebellious law clerk who goes out. I recommend a book called Closed Chambers by a guy named Edward Lazarus. He was a clerk to Justice, I believe, Brennan, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
I could be wrong. But every once in a while, you have clerks who reveal the kind of things that happens between chambers. Why is that? Because justices care about results. They don't just care about law. And so if they think, gee, you know, this other justice is asking me to sort of keep my powder dry right now and not vote this way in this particular case, so maybe or maybe tone down my position in exchange for a favorable agreement in another case that they care about. So there are all sorts of agreements and strategies.
That's like members of Congress
you're talking about here.
Yeah,
and I hate to be too cynical. I'm always fear making my students too cynical every year. But
right. It's
pretty patently obvious that the justices see themselves as largely legislators from the bench, quite frankly.
And that idea, I imagine, is going to really surprise some of our listeners that they don't view the Supreme Court as operating anything close to that ever.
Well, you know, there's a judge, Richard Posner on the U.S. Seventh Circuit, who's probably this has been empirically verified, the most cited legal scholar in American history, who is particularly honest, brutally honest about the way judges make decisions. And he basically says, look, judges, especially the higher up at the appellate level, recognize that they're sort of wise elders. And even they may not admit that they do so, they behave in that way.
Meaning, as you said before, they don't always act based on the legalities of any one case.
Yeah, there's a sort of theoretical idea of what a justice in the court does. They look at the facts, they research the law, they apply it to the facts, and they, in a sort of scientific way, deductive way, decide what the legally correct answer is. That's utterly unrealistic. You don't have to be super cynical to understand that, right? For example, there have been studies done that have shown that the most reliable way of predicting how a justice will decide a particular case is by looking at the president who appointed them, the party of that president, right? We see these 5-4 splits happen all the time, and we have for decades now, that very much correspond to the culture wars and how, you know, the particular political sides are likely to come down on a particular issue. I think it's unfair to say that justices see themselves as only legislators from the bench.
Mm-hmm.
I think they do make a good faith effort to be faithful to constitutionalism in some level, but I think that they understand that there's a lot more at play than just that.
That's really interesting stuff. I want to thank Edward Cantu, an associate professor at the UMKC School of Law, for explaining dissent to us and a little bit about how the U.S. Supreme Court operates. Edward, thanks very much. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.